Welcome into another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I'm Rick. He's Dan. Dan, this is the 31st episode of this podcast.
That's correct. A lot of you out there might have thought we got canceled after episode number 30. It was such a, I guess it was sort of a glorious shambles of a podcast with Brian Snow the last time around. But we apologize.
Glorious shambles is a good way to describe Brian Snow's career, by the way.
Well, it's been 5 weeks since we spoke. There's a lot to get to today, and we will get to everything that's on your mind, conference, schedule, newcomers, returning players, potpourri, media, etc. As Rick said, podcast number 31, you think of 31. In modern Xavier basketball, you think of Jason Love, who – in his 4 years at Xavier, X won 108 games. I believe that's now second. I think Dante Jackson nipped him for that record in total wins. But when Xavier fans talk about college basketball and talk about four-year players, Jason Love is almost sort of the perfect example of what they're talking about, isn't he, Rick?
Yes, and I think this is a good time. You know, we've got a lot of young guys coming into the program this year. There's also James Farr, who's kind of taking a beating on the board and everything. I think the 31st episode of this podcast is a great opportunity to remind all the fans out there to give guys a chance. What were your impressions of Jason Love after his first year and a half at Xavier?
Well, I mean, I didn't really have an impression of him because he was pretty much a non-entity. All I knew is that he was a kid that came to Xavier without any real fanfare. He was physically huge, but he struggled with his weight, and he didn't really appear to have any skill whatsoever. And then by the time he's a junior, he's one of the best players on the team. And as a senior, he was absolutely maybe the best big man in the Atlantic 10 Conference his senior year, fashioned himself into an extraordinarily reliable free throw shooter, and was a huge team leader for that team that went to the Sweet 16 and almost beat Kansas State.
That's exactly right. That's all I'm saying. You got to give some of these guys a chance, right? Let's start though, Dan. A lot of news you mentioned. We got a lot to get to, but there's been a few things going on with the Big East Conference, and obviously we're just a few days away from the big switchover on July 1st. Xavier will officially become a member of the Big East Conference. It's going to be a big event. They got things going on at Fountain Square, and then it's Xavier night at the Reds game, and Chris Mack and Amy Waugh are going to be putting out the lineups. By the way, do you think Chris Mack would bat lefties back-to-back?
Well, my first question is, if Chris bats Zach Cozart second, I'm turning in my season tickets.
Oh, without question.
And I'm going to tweet him to that effect after this podcast. Yeah, I think he would. Chris grew up, he's older than we are. He grew up during sort of the late Big Red Machine era. He knows, he has some familiarity with Sparky Anderson, who was kind of a revolutionary in his lineup, construction. So yeah, I think Rick wouldn't be opposed to batting Votto and Bruce back to back.
Yeah. Yeah, and you got Robinson and Chu up at the top of the lineup, so we're going a lot of lefties, I would imagine, is what I'm hoping for out of C-Mac when he turns in that lineup card. But, the other thing is he's had to deal with a lot of, shorthanded situations to where he's done a good job of sort of mixing and matching and finding lineups that work. So hopefully he can help the Redlegs, who are struggling big time right now.
Definitely true. So, yeah, as you mentioned, some news came out from the Big East yesterday, I believe, they announced Commissioner Val Ackerman, a former commissioner of the WNBA, but more recently was the president of USA Basketball, which I think is kind of an interesting wrinkle in her career. The hire has gotten great reviews from everybody I've read. Ackerman is considered one of the most connected basketball-first executives out there. There was a great article, I think, on Rush the Court, which is a general college basketball blog, talking about how the old Big East, the AAC, had hired Mike Oresko for the purposes of trying to find this, football TV contract that would keep them afloat and keep them BCS in. Meanwhile, the Big East has responded by saying, you know what, We don't care about any of that. We want a basketball person, somebody who's got decades of experience in the basketball community. I thought the fact that David Stern was quoted in all the press releases just with glowing recommendations for Ackerman's career with the WNBA was really nice to see. And I think it seems like, at least from the outside, a great hire.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, on first mention of the hire, I think, you know, admittedly, I know nothing about Ackerman going into this. I think, oh, WNBA, and that's the experience there. Not, you know, and then I see those comments from David Stern everywhere, and that honestly at first almost made me more nervous. I'm starting to think, like, who is she buddies with that was able, you know what I mean? Like, how, she must be really connected for these people to kind of go to bat for her. So I keep reading, and some of the stuff I really like that I'm hearing about her. One, you know, several people are calling her just a basketball mind, as you mentioned. She's basketball first and foremost, and she seems to understand. Second, the one thing about the WNBA, she saw it when it was a startup. She started with the WNBA and saw it too. I mean, honestly, I didn't expect the WNBA to ever achieve the success that they've had and be able to sustain itself as long as it had. And she was a big part of that. So I think that's interesting when you look at the Big East being sort of a startup in its own right. And then the other thing that I really, really liked that she said was that she's pretty happy with 10 right now as far as numbers of teams in the conference. I got her quote right here. She said, right now we love 10. 10 is a great number. That's what we have, and we have no immediate plans to go beyond it. To be honest, we have so much on our plate right now. Expansion isn't even on the radar screen with all the other things we have to get the conference up and running. I agree with her. I like 10. You've got 10 right now. Roll with it. Worry about expansion down the road if you need to. I don't know that you ever need to, though. I don't know that there's a lot to be gained by expanding. And right now, I think the conference is in good hands with Ackerman. I mean, from anything I can see, she seems like a good hire at this point.
Yeah, and I like the fact that one of the things she said was sort of in a self-deprecating manner. She talked about how the league office right now is her and her iPhone.
Right, right.
But she really seems to embrace the opportunity to, as she said, create a model athletic conference and an exciting new basketball organization. And like you said, being there on the ground floor with the WNBA, granted the WNBA, unlike, say, MLS, had a leg up because it's always had that support from the NBA.
Right.
But, I mean, at this stage, the WNBA is pretty viable. I mean, it's been around for, what, 15 years,
the
something
fact
like
that.
It
still exists, honestly, surprises me if you would have asked me when it started. I mean, right. I really didn't think it would survive.
And so beyond the Ackerman hiring, and now we're starting to see, obviously, the pieces get put into place, and I have little doubt that things will be developing at a furious pace as the league office is put together and as schedules are worked out and everything else. Also, some interesting news from the media side. And, Rick, this is something I know you were overjoyed to hear today.
Yeah, I was all types of fired up. Obviously, we know Gus Johnson is a huge part of what they're doing with Fox Sports 1. And he was there with the introduction of the Big East and when they made the initial announcement, he hosted that whole thing. So he's been a huge part of this to begin with, and we knew he was going to be calling the big games. But today they announced that Bill Raftery is leaving ESPN, leaving Jay Billis and Big Monday, and coming to join up with Gus Johnson as the top tandem for Big East play. And that, I mean, to me, that's a dream scenario as far as broadcasters. I'm a big fan of Gus Johnson, and there's no one more entertaining to you to listen to as a color guy than Raftery. And to be honest, if you're a color guy, I want one of two things. I want you to be either super not necessarily have a great basketball mind, but be really good at explaining some of the finer points of basketball. I don't need you to get into minute details that I'm not going to understand, like a la Bob Knight, and get ridiculous and just be an idiot half the time. I want details that you're really good at explaining and saying, like, hey, here's how this guy got that shot, or here's the little set play that they ran, and a lot of teams run this to accomplish so-and-so. That's the type of stuff I want to hear, and Raftery, obviously, is the opposite. He's super, super entertaining, along with a little bit of basketball knowledge. So as long as it's one of those two, I'm happy, and Raftery certainly brings that, and combined with Gus Johnson, the energy in those broadcasts is just going to be electric. I know you not quite as excited as I am about this.
Well, first of all, when you talk about what, first of all, when you talk about what you're looking for from an analyst on a broadcast, I couldn't agree with you more. Obviously, you either want the technician, somebody that can tell you how the game is being played. And the two examples that come to mind immediately for me are Doris Burke and Jeff Van Gundy.
I agree.
Want the person that's bringing the energy, that's entertaining, that's got the – that. But the thing about Raftery is that he does that, – that even beyond the shtick that he does, he is a guy that really understands the game and has been around it for, you know, longer than you and I have been alive, longer than probably our parents have been alive.
Right.
So I think it's great to have Raf aboard. I think it's great that he's staying with the Big East, because really his career was made by those early ESPN Big Monday, Big East broadcasts. So I think it's great that he's aboard. You know, my issue with Gus Johnson is that, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, because we're going to talk a little bit more at the end of the podcast about, especially for me, watching the Stanley Cup and seeing the way that Mike Emmerich goes about calling a game. But I guess Gus is great at those big moments in games, but I've been really underwhelmed with what he's done over the last year as Fox has tried to sort of groom him to be their voice of the World Cup. So hopefully going back to basketball will sort of re-energize him, because I've found him to be real lackluster in his soccer coverage.
See, and that's why I'm not worried, because that's what I was thinking. I'm like, the only thing I can imagine you're changing your opinion on is his soccer coverage. And I mean, I agree, you're a professional, you got to be able to do the job either way. But I mean, let's be honest. If you told me to go out there and cover soccer right now, I'm barely okay at this job. I'd be freaking horrible at covering soccer. I mean, it just wouldn't be the same deal. I wouldn't be into it the same way. And, I mean, that's an indictment on you as a professional, obviously, but I'm not near as concerned about him coming back to basketball. I think, there's a lot more enjoyment in calling basketball for him, and I think he'll do a fine job, as in my opinion, he always has.
It will be interesting to see how those two personalities interact,
no doubt,
in calling a basketball game, because it could go – I mean, I could see a scenario where you put two super high-energy guys like that on the same broadcast and it becomes intolerable. Yeah. I could also see it being really effective and really exciting and really building the drama and the enjoyment of the games. But certainly one thing you have to tip your cap to the way Fox has built this network is that gets attention. You bring over a guy who's been a top analyst for ESPN for 30 years, that's been extremely well exposed in his work with the NCAA tournament with CBS. I mean, obviously it moves a needle, I think. And I think it's fantastic, and I can't wait to see how it works. Another thing that came out of this sort of first blast of news about the Big East is that conference play is going to start off with a marathon on New Year's Eve. And from what we understand, from what was sort of tweeted about today, I don't know that there's been an actual press release, but it sounds like all 10 conference teams will start their league schedule on New Year's Eve. It sounds like X is going to host St. John's in the first game of a marathon that'll start at noon or sometime in the afternoon and proceed throughout the day with all 10 teams in action. And then I think Creighton and Marquette in the nightcap. And that's going to be a great day of basketball. And it's going to be a great day to sort of inaugurate this new league, I feel like.
It just hit me. I'm never going to have to write a matchups article about Fordham again. Like, well, I literally just got, like, goosebumps a little bit there when you were talking about the marathon. And, like, I'm like, that's stupid. Why would I do that? I'm like, oh, yeah. Because you're talking about St. John's coming to CentOS. You're talking about the rest of the day watching teams like Georgetown and Marquette and all these other teams. There's no Fordham involved. There's no Fordham.
Yeah, and there's not going to be any more of those random 3 or 4 road conference games a year where you have to, like, watch the game through, like, some Uzbeki farmer's sling box because he's capturing it off the local station in Olean, New York or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things.
I'm going to have to ask my little brother to borrow his Xbox to watch some ESPN 3 webcast on there.
Right, right. Right. And you could, but the nice thing about the ESPN3 webcast is you can switch directly over to watch Drexel play Towson in women's basketball right afterwards.
That is a lost benefit that doesn't get near enough publicity.
Or like a lacrosse game between Johns Hopkins and I don't know.
Anyway, going back to just your point real quick, finished up that Raftery thing there, though, I think that is the biggest thing is people, we can talk a little bit about this Dana O'Neill article. She wrote an article, The New Big East Circus Rolls On, basically just crushing the Big East and the decision makers, the presidents, everything to go with it. And obviously she works for ESPN, so we know where that's coming from. But I think this is a big statement by Fox Sports. When you steal Raftery from ESPN, and not only are you taking away from Big Monday, but you're also – just think about the fringe fans that are watching basketball. I mean, what do you see – as a Xavier guy, I'm sure you follow a lot of Xavier people as I do. And, Xavier's not playing on a Monday night or whatever, and you're watching TV. What do you see all over Twitter? Hashtag onions. All this stuff about Raftery, pick up the lingerie, all this stuff. Well, that's not what you're going to get when him and Gus Johnson are calling games on Fox Sports 1. And there's been a lot of talk about, it's not going to be the Big East. Chad Brendel, who's one of my cohorts on FM 100, The Fan, who covers UC in a similar capacity the way I cover Xavier, is constantly talking about, it's not really the Big East anymore. And one of his big contentions is like, without ESPN, it's not going to be the same. And I'm like, in 2013, I just don't agree with that. I think you have to take some measures to make sure that it becomes as big and it becomes a legit sports network. But I think, this move with Raftery and things like this marathon they're talking about New Year's Eve, stuff like that will definitely make a big impact as far as making Fox Sports 1 the next big sports network.
Well, in response to Brendel, I would say this. And granted that I'm getting to be an old man, I got a kid, I got a mortgage, the whole nine yards, probably an ulcer too. The real Big East, the actual Big East, existed long before UC was part of it. So,
right.
So don't lecture me about the real Big East, pal, because I was around watching Syracuse and Georgetown in the early 90s. So,
no question. And it'll concede that. It's not just a UC thing. And other people have this claim. I mean, it's not just UC fan. It's not just a little brother thing. In Brendel's case, it can be to an extent. But there is a legit argument that I've heard from people that, and I think you do lose something by taking the Big East and moving away from the ESPN. ESPN is obviously built up to the point that it's not going to be hurt by it, really. But the Big East, yeah, it could be if not in the right hands. But the way they're building Fox Sports 1, the people they're bringing in, Val Ackerman, like I said, seems to be a good hire. All these things combined really alleviates any fears that I would have about the Big East remaining one of the top basketball conferences.
The only risk that exists out there is that because the Big East is not a ESPN property, that it'll get short shrift on that network. And of course, ESPN built college basketball in this country to a large extent, made it what it is today. So I respect that, yeah, that there is some tension and there's some concern about it. But I think when Fox makes this kind of commitment and when it's available for everybody with a basic cable package, I don't have a whole lot of concern. And when the average college basketball fan gets the opportunity for the first time really to watch in prime time games from Omaha and from Hinkle Fieldhouse and from CentOS Center, they're gonna love it.
Yeah,
and
I
can tell you, I'm actually on an email list of a bunch of guys that I've met through various connections over the years, guys that live all over the country, all of them huge college basketball fans, and everyone is pumped for this new Big East because it's a basketball-centric conference. It's playing a balanced schedule, and it just is – it's the first time in a long time that there's been a league that's not screwing around with football at all and is going to be right there and has the quality at the top of the league. It's going to have teams that can compete for a national title. It's going to have teams that can compete for at-large bids. It's hard not to be excited about this inaugural season and, of course, the seasons to come.
Yeah, and again, it's not just a Xavier perspective. It's just for basketball in general. I mean, I'm excited to see decisions being made with basketball in mind. and you know, a whole conference bringing in a commissioner who's just a basketball person. I mean, that's who she is. I'm excited about that. I think, again, I don't have really any concerns at this point about the Big East losing legitimacy as a conference. I just don't think it'll happen. I think it's getting to the point that if they continue to make the right decisions, and Fox Sports 1 does continue to do big things like this, like getting in Raftery and continue to build the fan base up, that it's going to hurt ESPN more than anything if they continue to try to act like the Big East all of a sudden doesn't exist because, you know, it's not affiliated with ESPN anymore. But I'm sure we could continue talking about that till we're blue in the face. Dan, one of the other things we wanted to get to, this actually happened a while ago at the beginning of June, and I don't think we've gotten the chance to talk about it because, as you mentioned, we've been on a little bit of a break from the podcast, is the release of the non-conference schedule.
Right. And this has been, you know, we'd had Mario on, I believe, not the last podcast, but the one before it.
Yeah, right.
And he gave us sort of a lead into the schedule. Now, some things have changed in the intervening time, and we should probably bring these up. I'm sure this is old news for most people listening to this, because if you're listening to this podcast, you also read the message board probably and have seen all this information already. But the Tennessee game, which initially was slated to be part of the ESPN 24-hour marathon, has been pulled probably due to this whole Fox versus ESPN deal, but I believe that it was said that that is now going to be – it's now going to be an evening game, and I believe it's going to be on primetime on Fox Sports 1. So
that's correct. Yep.
You know, they'll probably be up against Michigan State and North Carolina or something like that, probably playing on the, you know, the deck of a clipper ship or whatever ESPN decides this year. But so that's a change. Also, initially, Xavier was supposed to start a home-and-home series with Northwestern on the road this year. That series has been shelved for the time being. I think our understanding is that when Northwestern fired Bill Carmody and replaced him with Chris Collins, that Northwestern decided to go in a different direction with their non-conference schedule.
Yeah, well, it wasn't necessarily that he didn't want to play that. He just had just taken the job, and he said, let me get my bearings straight. Let's see what's going on. I'm not sure if this is going to really work for us. More than likely, he's probably sitting there going like, damn, there's a lot of L's sitting here in my non-conference schedule. I need to get rid of a couple of these to turn this program around. And he sort of said, hey, can we take some time and maybe, you know, I need to think about this. And Xavier was like, you know what? With us moving into the Big East and playing DePaul, we're in the Chicago market now. James Farr will get to play in front of a hometown crowd, things of that nature. You know, I mean, those are a lot of times why you schedule games in different areas that you haven't played in before, is kind of get some of your kids back home, something like that, get into a different market. In this case, we're already going to be playing Chicago. Not a big deal for us. We don't need to keep it. If you're worried about that game, let's just part ways. And they replaced it with Alabama, which is pretty cool, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it gives me a little bit of the red ass because my sister lives in Chicago. I was hoping to go up there and stay with her for two road games this year, but one will have to do. So the Musketeers will open on Friday, November 8th against Gardner-Webb. They start the year off with four straight home games. They'll play Tennessee, as we mentioned, Morehead State. And then Miami of Ohio returns to schedule on the 19th.
And real quick, this is the last game between Xavier and Miami of Ohio that's scheduled under that contract that they currently have. They are in talks, though, to get a new one and to get that game continuing. And it sounds like it's going well. And I think that will happen. So I think they will continue to play Miami in the future.
Sub question. If they do, are we talking about a 2-for-1? Will Xavier go to Millette Hall anymore? Or will they work out some sort of neutral site for Miami's home games?
I would almost guarantee Xavier's not going to be going to Millett Hall. I don't know exactly what the terms of the agreement will be, but I would be very surprised if Xavier's going up to Millett Hall anymore.
You know, I've got an out-of-the-box idea. Miami's got a ton of alumni in Cincinnati. Played at Bank of Kentucky Arena.
There you go.
It'd be closer for you anyway.
Yeah, I'm good.
Then over the Thanksgiving holiday, I believe, the Musketeers head to the Bahamas for the Battle for Atlantis. Some great teams in that, Kansas, Iowa, USC, UTEP, in addition to Wake Forest, Villanova, and Tennessee, who are all on the schedule already. After the Battle for Atlantis – and actually, we should throw in there that the Battle for Atlantis actually includes a guarantee game as well. We're not sure who the opponent is going to be, but I think you can probably bank on that being a low major. Hopefully not quite as bad as Fairleigh Dickinson last year, but probably on a similar level.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be one of those teams that's, you know, like Wake or Villanova or Tennessee or anything like that that they're going to see down in the Bahamas. So
right. And then the December schedule, the Musketeers will host Bowling Green. And then on Tuesday, December 10th, Evansville comes to town. We'll see if Chris Mack breaks out the old sleeve jersey for that one. Musketeers will play UC in the Crosstown Cuddle Fest at U.S. Bank Arena on Saturday, December the 14th. And then they'll travel to Tuscaloosa the following Saturday to play Alabama Skip Prosser Classic on December 28th against Wake. And then the 31st, St. John's, and off we go with the Big East schedule.
It's definitely a step back from what we've kind of seen in the past, which is expected. I mean, the conference schedule is going to be tougher, obviously, than it has in the past. The only other thing that really interests me here is that there's only one real road game in this schedule. I mean, obviously you got the game against UC at US Bank Arena, but at Alabama on December 21st is really your only road game other than the trip to the Bahamas. So, you know, I don't know how many, you know, they're not going to play in many tough environments before they go into the Big East play, and with a young cast of not necessarily the main guys you're counting on, but mostly any backup is going to be a first-year guy this year, it might play a little bit of a role. I don't think it's a huge deal, but it is something that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, there's no doubt that this non-conference schedule is a pretty substantial step back. But on the other hand, if the Musketeers say – you know, beat an Iowa or something like that in their first game in the battle for Atlantis, and they end up playing two games down there against, say, Kansas and, I don't know, Villanova, who then they'll play twice more. I mean, that all of a sudden becomes a pretty arduous non-conference schedule. Now, obviously, if they go into the loser's bracket and they end up playing UTEP and, you know, Wake Forest again, then probably not. But they're going to have that opportunity to get themselves some nice non-conference opportunities in that Atlantis tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. And if they end up doing that, I mean, their RPI should be through the roof, assuming they win some of these games by the end of the year, because you've got the Big East Conference schedule, obviously. And then, I mean, Tennessee's pretty darn good. And
yeah,
Alabama's
yeah.
not going to be bad at all this year. And Wake Forest has been terrible recently. They're not going to be good this year necessarily, but they're going to be all right.
So I do have to hand it to Mario Mercurio, who seems to be trying to, in his time at Xavier, complete the entire circuit of the SEC on the road.
Yep.
And I think so. Maybe Rick Carter can, who's the next person we're going to talk about, can hook him up with Missouri in a couple of years, so we can fill out that oval.
That's right.
But that brings us to our next topic. What a segue! I should be on the news.
That's big time.
I should really be on the
FM
news.
FM 100, the fans gonna be calling you sooner.
Oh my god! So one of the things that happened since the last time we convened this podcast was Ashley Howard electing to leave the Xavier coaching staff and take a position on Jay Wright's staff at Villanova. This led to a couple things. One is the developments in the Melvin Swift recruitment, which we'll get back to. But the other was that Xavier again had a vacancy on the assistant coaching staff. Rick, this led to a lot of hand-wringing, rending of garments, wearing of, as the Bible says, sackcloth and ashes. Because, first of all, no one had anything to talk about. But also, there have been a lot of assistant coaches that have departed Cintas Center over the last 2 or 3 years. Pat Kelsey, Kareem Richardson, Beano Ransom, et cetera.
Rasheen Davis. Right.
First question, is this something to be concerned about, or is this just the nature of the beast these days?
To me, it's the nature of the beast. Again, if there was like, you know, if all these guys are leaving for kind of fishy reasons, and there seems to be this big growing thing that Chris Mack either is a completely shady character and the program's doing something that's not right and guys just don't want to be involved with it, or if it's that he's impossible to work for, that'd be fine. But, I mean, that's clearly not the case. Rick Carter just left Missouri to come to Xavier. So that's clearly not the case. These things happen. If you look around, it was funny because I was just reading an article earlier this week, and now I can't remember who the heck it was about, but it was the same thing. It was a fan base losing their minds over the fact that this the new head coach who – God, who was it? Has lost a bunch of assistants in the past 3 years. So, I mean, a very similar situation to Xavier. It's not the only place it happens. I mean, when you're talking about all the transfers we have with players, it's the same way with assistant coaches. I mean, they're moving just as often, and it's not a good thing. I mean, you want continuity in your program, and obviously in this case with Ashley Howard taking a position where he's getting paid more back home, it's tough to compete with that. But I know Chris Mack obviously wants his guys paid more. I mean, Xavier's not paying their assistants top dollar compared to other schools in the conference. And now in the Big East, they're probably towards the bottom. So that's something that they're going to have to look at stepping up. And I know Chris Mack is going to continue to push for that. But I don't think it's anything to worry about at this point as far as why those guys left or their reasons for leaving.
Well, I know one fan base that's freaked out over losing a bunch of assistants this offseason is the University of Louisville, which just won, you know, the national title.
Well, exactly.
So, yeah. Xavier moved pretty deliberately to fill this hole. Although we had heard a lot of talk about Rick Carter long before he was officially announced. Carter is a guy. He's a relatively young guy, 34 years old. He is a native of the Flint, Michigan area. Was a assistant with, I believe, Tom Izzo for a little while, then 4 years at Western Michigan University, where he coached, among others, a gentleman by the name of Matt Stainbrook, and then moved on to Mizzou, spent 1 year on Frank Haith's staff with the Tigers last season. Rick, you've had the opportunity to meet Coach Carter, if I may call him that, that's a movie, but
yeah, it is.
You've had the opportunity to meet Coach Carter, interact with him a little bit. What are your impressions of him just as a person, I guess, before we even get to the basketball side of things?
You know, honestly, I really haven't been around him much at all, actually. I saw him at team camp. He was there, but, you know, it hasn't he's just gotten to Xavier within the last couple of weeks, and there hasn't been a ton going on, so I really haven't been up there to interact with him much, but you know, here's the thing. He knew Brad Redford. He had a previous relationship with Brad Redford from coaching him before he committed to Xavier. And the Xavier staff has had a relationship with him for a while. He's been a guy who was up for the job when Ashley Howard was hired, actually, and before he took the job at Missouri. So he's definitely a guy that I think Coach Mack felt really comfortable with and had a really good relationship with to begin with. And, you know, I think – put it this way, more than anything, I think this is a very good fit personality-wise, and just with – I think he's going to fit in great on the staff. Not that the other guys didn't in the past, but I think there's no worries as far as how he's going to get along or whether he's going to want to be here or not. Plus, it's in the Midwest, and he's pretty close to home.
Rick, first question, what will Carter's role on the team be in terms of skill coaching, and what recruiting area will he focus on?
As far as what his role with the team will be, I'm really not sure. I mean, Steele kind of takes the offense and the guards, and Mike Pegues works with the bigs. I'm guessing Carter will probably work with the guards or wings in some way and do stuff like that. But that'll work itself out as we get closer to the season. I'll give a better report on that. As far as where he's recruiting, you know, the funny thing is we're actually probably a little bit off on here. He's got great connections in Michigan, and he's definitely going to recruit there some. But Coach Steele's already recruiting Michigan pretty heavily. And the one spot where I think they really need some help at, Steele's tried to recruit it a little bit, but I think he feels like he needs a little more help with him already sort of locking down Indiana and Michigan, is Illinois. And then in addition to that, a couple places I really didn't even know is he's going to extend farther west a little bit and get into places like Minnesota and Nebraska and some of the plains. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see some of the guys that Rick Carter gets them in on and in some areas that Xavier really has never recruited before, at least since I've been following the program.
Well, moving on from Carter, one of the byproducts of Ashley Howard's departure was that there was some potential turmoil with the recruitment of Melvin Swift, who was the first Xavier verbal commit for the incoming class of 2014. Now, Swift has chosen to stay committed, but there's also been a pretty, I guess the new Scout Top 100 for 2014 came out this week, and Swift experienced a pretty dramatic drop. Can you tell us sort of what the status is with Swift and whether what the current thinking is about his role when he arrives next year?
Okay, I'm gonna try to be as honest as possible here, and this isn't really inside information or anything as much as it is just me being straight with you guys and looking at the situation from an honest perspective. Melvin Swift committed to Xavier. They really didn't know a whole lot about him when he committed. I mean, it was a guy Ashley Howard had a relationship with, but they really hadn't been recruiting him long at all. Things with Des Wells happened. They were sort of struggling on the recruiting front. They needed some momentum. They got that commitment, and Howard was able to lock Swift up for them pretty quickly. And, I mean, you're looking at it, he's a top 100 kid. He's a freak athlete. It looks like a great commitment, and at the time it certainly was, if for no other reason than for people to kind of look at the program and say, hey, got this kid, got Brandon Randolph a few weeks later. They're in good shape. They're fine. As things go on, you know, one, Swift really hasn't developed, or at least seemingly we haven't heard reports of Swift developing his game offensively to what you would probably like to hear. He's a freak athlete, and guys, the knock on him was always sort of that he's a four right now who either needs to become more of a combo forward and a three, or needs to get a little bit bigger and develop a little more offensive game inside, because right now he's more of a transition scorer and a freak athlete. As things go along, he didn't play really anywhere this spring. So, he dropped out of the top 100, and someone asked if he would have been, like, in a top 150, and Snow said, I don't think he would have been in consideration. I don't think those guys have seen him play anywhere since the last time they ranked him. And that hurts you. I mean, regardless of what they say, that's going to hurt you in the rankings. If you're not out there proving yourself against these guys, in the scouts' minds, they're going to pass you up. And in my opinion, it's warranted. I mean, if you're not willing to go out there and prove yourself, and I'm not saying Swift might have been taking care of summer school. I mean, it's not like it's a huge deal that he wasn't out there, but from a ranking standpoint, I can see why he certainly dropped, and I don't think that it's like, you know, the scouts are screwing him in any way, shape, or form. There hasn't been any reports of him making the progression that you'd like to hear about, and he didn't go out there and show it this spring, and he didn't make NBA players camp because he was at summer school. So that's part of it right there is where things are at with Swift. As far as where things are at with Xavier and Swift, when Howard left, from what I heard, Howard didn't call him. He's not trying to take him to Villanova with him. He did Xavier a solid there as far as saying, you know, I recruited him to Xavier, he's committed to Xavier, that's done. Swift was left to make basically the decision on his own whether he wanted to stay with this commitment or, you know, decommit because Howard left. And to this point, you know, he left a statement or made a statement on Twitter a couple days after Howard left and said, I'm going to stick with Xavier. Now, he could certainly change his mind, and that wouldn't be much of a shock considering the coach who recruited him there left. So I think Xavier is going to have to, for one, look at that situation and say, there's no one on staff who has any type of relationship with this kid at all right now. It was Ashley's guy, Ashley's gone, and we really took a commitment without knowing the kid a whole lot. And that's not a knock on the staff. I think they did the right thing when they took the commitment. But now that Howard's gone, you got to start wondering about things. You know, how's he going to feel when he comes up here and doesn't know our staff? How's he, you know, why is he not showing up to some of these things? I think there are definitely question marks surrounding Melvin Swift right now. At least if it was me, there would be. And maybe the staff has a better read that I don't know about. Also, when you look at as far as his game goes, I think the staff would have to look at it and say, hey, he's not developing the way we thought. Is he, you know, is he going to be there when it's time, or is he going to decide, hey, I'm going to play somewhere else where I can get more minutes or something like that? There's a lot of moving parts to this, and I think more than anything, that's why you've seen Xavier. They were already recruiting some fours to begin with, and I think that's why you've continued to see them bring guys in on visits and continue the recruiting process with guys like Justin Tillman and Jalen Johnson, another guy from Michigan. So I wouldn't freak out and say, oh, Swift is gone. I wouldn't freak out if he did decommit and say, oh, they lost, you know, the prize gem of their 2014 recruiting class. I just think it's a situation that Xavier kind of did the right thing at that time, and now they're doing the right thing by preparing for a situation if Swift were to decommit.
Okay, and so as of now, Swift is still committed, still right. A verbal commit. Edmund Sumner also is in the loop for 2014. We'll come back to 2014. Let's talk about the newcomers for this year. 2013 incoming class, You've got Kamal. You've got Brandon. And Kamal really put on a show at the first on the first game day of the Devereaux League. First of all, Rick, can you explain to our listeners, because not all of them may be from Cincinnati, what is the City Gear / Devereaux Summer League? Where is it held? If you want to go, when does it take place? Where can you get information about it, et cetera?
Okay, let's start with the specific. It's at Woodward High School, and it's played every Saturday and Sunday for the next, I don't know, six weeks, something like that. And then they play on Wednesday nights as well, just like two or three games every Wednesday night. Basically, it's a very impressive summer league. I mean, it's not the biggest. There's a couple bigger ones like in North Carolina and obviously at Rucker in New York, things of that nature. You know, if you remember, Tu Holloway got dinged first game or two of the season last year for playing in too many summer leagues. That's what it was. He played in Devereaux, and then he played at Rucker in the league there when he went back home, and that's what he got dinged for. So there are other big leagues, but it's funny because there were a lot of guys up for Xavier's team camp, not this past weekend, but the weekend before, and a lot of the guys from Detroit went up there to see Jalen play in the summer league, Jalen Reynolds. And, you know, they got up there, and they're like, wow, this is nothing like the summer league we've got back home. Like, this is a much higher level that these guys are playing. I mean, you've got – here's the thing. You've got, all, like, legit 6'7 to 6'10 guys in the post. You've got legit point guards from Division I schools out on the perimeter. I mean, it's guys who can really play. It's high-level athletes. So it's not just a bunch of schmucks. Now, the other thing is it is a summer league. There's not set plays. There are guys dogging it. There is a lot of trash talking. There are a lot of fouls. There is a lot of one-on-one. And there's not great defense. So if you're looking, if you're going up there from a fundamental perspective and you're looking for good GCL basketball, you're not going to find it. If you're looking to see what type of skill set a guy may have or how he kind of plays when he's loose and running open gym, great opportunity to see guys' physical makeup and kind of how they interact with teammates.
And you mentioned the quality of the players that are there. I mean, in past years, it's pretty much the entire roster. Well, all the guys that are in town anyway, for Xavier, a lot of guys from UC, you'll see most of the guys from NKU, you'll see Miami guys, Dayton guys, even, you know, occasionally an Ohio State guy. And then you have guys that are alumni of those schools that are hanging around town that are still playing at a high level. So
right.
It's,
well, Cincinnati State always has a team in there as well, and they bring their full team. Because if you're not in Division One, you can only have two current players from a given school's roster on the same team, according to NCAA rules. So that's why they'll throw like all the newcomers. Newcomers don't count towards that. So they'll throw like all the freshmen on one team, which is always Deer Park Roofing for Xavier's case. And then they can play with two upperclassmen. So in this case, it's Samaje this year with Deer Park Roofing. And I don't know who the other upperclassmen will be because they haven't shown up yet. But that's how that works. So, but if you're not in Division One, like Cincinnati State and NKU in the past, although now they have to abide by those rules, you can just throw your whole team in there, which is what Cincinnati State does. So that's obviously a pretty good team when they're bringing like 14, 15 guys that are all legit college basketball players and in shape playing. You get guys from overseas. This past weekend, Shane Bahannon, who's a Cincinnati native, current member of Louisville, was up there playing. So it's pretty high-level stuff.
Yeah. And you mentioned newcomers, so you'll be able to see. In fact, I think Remy Abel is playing for one of the teams. Correct.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to see all the newcomers, including the freshmen and the transfers.
Right. And Remy, I believe, will be playing with Deer Park Roofing. I think he'll be getting here around like July 1st. So that's good. And Brandon Randolph actually is arrived tonight, this evening in Cincinnati. So I do believe he'll be playing there this weekend.
Yeah, and we apologize in advance to the message board denizens that Rick wasn't there to film Brandon moving into his dorm room tonight. I mean, that's, you know, kind of dropping the ball. But anyway, Kamal Richards was the big story from your trip to the Summer League last weekend. You posted some video. He looked fantastic. What did you learn about his game?
Well, let's start with what we knew about him coming in. And again, this is a guy that I really didn't get to watch much. It was, you know, Ashley Howard got the commitment again, so he was new to the staff I didn't get a chance to go out and like – Kamal Richards isn't a guy they were recruiting from the get-go and then eventually got a commitment from. It was a new guy that Ashley Howard brought with him, and then they got a quick commitment. So I never really got the chance to check him out much on the AAU circuit. I'd seen very minimal video, and Snow had seen him several times. So that's kind of what we're going off of. And it's basically, you know, Snow had even thrown around the term like Justin Cage because of the way that Richards plays, in the sense that he plays physical, he's tough, he plays hard, he likes to defend, likes to rebound, things of that nature.
Can I interrupt you and say, sure, just the mention of Justin Cage is like Viagra substitute for every Xavier fan between the ages of like 35 and 50.
Oh yeah, that's why I brought it up. And if you remember at the time when Snow said that on the podcast, like I tweeted about it three different times and was completely right, freaked out that he had made that comparison. But now that I've seen Kamal Richards play in the summer league, I have to say he's smaller than what I was thinking. If he's 6'6", he doesn't quite look it. I'd say he's closer to 6'5". He looked about 2 inches taller than Samaje, who I believe is around 6'3". So I'm going to say he's about 6'5". He wasn't quite as, again, as long or tall as I expected, but he's strong. I mean, he's strong for an incoming freshman, and he plays extremely hard. He was attacking the glass kamikaze style every single time a shot went up, particularly on the offensive end, and he seems to be one of those guys who just has a knack. Sort of in the way, I know people aren't going to want to hear this right now, but Justin Martin is a better offensive rebounder than he is defensive for whatever reason. He just seems to have a good nose for how the ball is going to come off. It's another opportunity for him to score, whatever it is that gets him going on the offensive glass. He does a great job of seeking out those rebounds. Kamal Richards seemed to do the same exact thing with the way that he was attacking the glass in summer league. So that was exciting to see. The most impressive part, and this is what we really didn't know what to expect at all, because for a school team, he's the biggest player on the team, and again, he plays extremely hard, likes to defend, likes to bang, likes to rebound. He's basically their center. I mean, on the offensive end, he'll move out a little bit, but he bangs inside the majority of the game for his high school team. And then for his AAU team, Snow saw him hit like three or four threes in one game and was like, what the hell's going on, man? Like, I saw you in school, you never even shot a three, which usually means you can't shoot. And then in here, or out here in AAU, you're shooting threes and making a couple. What's the deal? And Kamal was like, you know, it's a game, a part of my game I'm really working on is my skill level from the outside. From guys who came away, put it this way, the UC fans that were in attendance that knew nothing about him coming in are looking at him and freaking out because Xavier just got a knockdown shooter from the perimeter. In the second half, he lit it up. And again, they play with an NBA three-point line in the summer league. And I'm sure he knew that, or maybe he didn't, I don't know. But he was setting up like a foot inside of that every time. So he was just outside the college or regular three-point line, but he was just inside of the NBA three-point line. So he kept hitting like these 21-foot two-pointers and 22-foot two-pointers. Right. But either way, he was knocking them down consistently. And the other thing is he looked good in transition handling the ball, made a couple nice passes, one in particular that was in that highlight video where he's kind of running the break in traffic a little bit, breaks away from the pack, and then does a nice look-off bounce pass to Travis Taylor for a dunk. You can really see that he's comfortable with the ball in his hands. He has some skill level, and he knows how to play. So I think Kamal Richards at this point, and again, this is completely snap judgment. It's 1 hour open run in summer league. He looks like a guy who's definitely going to go into preseason and compete for minutes this year.
Well, I mean, what does this podcast exist for other than to make – poorly educated snap judgments.
Exactly. And that's what I'm here for.
So we'll know a little bit more about where Brandon Randolph is when after this weekend, when he's supposed to make his debut in the – is it called the City Gear League now?
Here's the thing. It's always been the Devereaux Summer League. This year they're trying to rebrand it because City Gear, I guess, is the new like big sponsor behind it. So now it's City Gear the League, which is just impossible to actually like write or say into anything. So they're screwing themselves, but they've asked me to do it. I've done it for like a week now. I'll probably be back to Devereaux Summer League by next week. I don't know.
Right, right. It's sort of the crosstown shootout principle. But anyway,
Cuddlefest.
Right. That's what I'm calling it from now on.
I like that.
So there has been one modification to the roster, and that is that Chris Cantino has chosen to depart Xavier, thereby ending a career that, I mean, he was sort of the man who wasn't there, the guy apparently was pretty well liked by his teammates. I'm sure he worked hard in practice, but he leaves Xavier never having played a minute, and it's one of the oddest stories I can remember being a Xavier fan over the last, 20 years.
It is an interesting situation, and there's a lot of people sort of looking at this, and they're getting mad for one reason or another, or they're at least questioning it for one reason or another. And look, there's certainly reason to do that. But I think there's a whole lot of weird circumstances that kind of made up the whole Chris Cantino saga at Xavier. The first was Des Wells got booted off the team. Xavier obviously kind of in panic, kind of looking like, hey, we're going to be really shorthanded at the three this year, which guess what? They were, and the fan base is brought that up numerous times on the message board.
Have they? I haven't noticed.
Oh, well, it's been up there a couple times. So they brought Chris Cantino in. Again, a guy that the staff didn't know a whole lot about. Ashley Howard had the connection with him, was able to get a quick commitment. And they're like, hey, if nothing else, it's another warm body. He's 6'7", and he can dribble the ball a little bit. It'll help. And he's got a little bit of athleticism, which all of those things are completely true, by the way, after watching him play Open Gym. However, there was an interesting situation that had to do with playing in a junior college showcase before his junior college career started, which for some reason the NCAA looks at that as basically competing in a season. So he had 1 year of eligibility left all of a sudden by the time he actually got ruled eligible by the NCAA, which was like the first week of the season. They had already played a game. He, again, was only given 1 year of eligibility. So Xavier looked at it as like, hey, you're already behind. You're not going to play this year from what we've seen. Do you want to just at least redshirt this year so you have the opportunity to graduate, get your degree by next year, and play a full year of eligibility and at least have a full offseason to kind of prepare and get ready for it? And he was like, yeah, that's great. As things turned out, they continue to go. Xavier lands a few more commitments going forward. They've got what looks to be a decent roster this year. Granted, they're going to be relying on young guys, but what also became increasingly more clear over time is that Chris Cantino's basketball IQ isn't the highest, and he can handle the ball a little bit, but that doesn't necessarily equate to being a great basketball player, and he's just not quite the best fit and probably not going to see any minutes on this team had he stayed. And again, he's only got 1 year of eligibility left, so as it turns out, he's going to transfer, move down a level so he's eligible and doesn't have to sit out this year. And it sounds like Pikeville is where he's going to end up.
So a Division II team.
I believe Pikeville is NAIA.
Oh, okay.
If I'm not mistaken, but you could be right.
Right. So that is sort of a interesting side note in these last couple of years of Xavier basketball.
Yeah, I mean, really had it happened to where like he was able to play last year, it would have worked out. I mean, exactly as Xavier expected. He had 1 year of eligibility. He would have played last year, and they would have had that extra body for last year when they really needed it. As it turns out, when he didn't play last year, they didn't quite need it as much going forward, and he only has 1 year left. So it's like, for him, the best decision was just to move on.
Okay. Well, let's move back to the recruiting trail. Cantino's departure, it does mean one additional scholarship is open for the 2013-14 season, but it doesn't seem likely at this stage in the game that Xavier's going to make any moves to fill that. I know that people kind of got excited when Kyle Wilcher from Kentucky announced he was transferring, but that's not really that's a non-starter for Xavier. So I guess the question becomes, but because of the way the scholarships work, the fact that the Cantino scholarship is open this year doesn't affect the number of scholarships that'll be open in upcoming seasons.
No, and that's the people are saying like, oh, they're not going to give that scholarship to Stanger or something because if they want a mid-year transfer, they won't be able to do it. You're right in the sense that they won't have the spot to take a mid-year transfer, but the only scenario I see them using the scholarship for someone new would be if some fifth-year guy just all of a sudden decides to transfer in the next couple of weeks here and they get a late fifth-year addition that can help them this year, because I don't think there's going to be many impact transfers wanting to do that mid-year. And you're taking up a scholarship going forward if you take any other transfer. So
right.
I mean, his scholarship was only for this year.
Right. And those issues that arise, I mean, the mid-year transfer, it almost always comes completely out of nowhere. I mean, like Smith for UCLA last year, where just the atmosphere on the team was so poisonous and he was just sort of forced out. It doesn't happen very often. So we'll see what they decide to do. It could be that Stenger gets another year on scholarship. Could be that he doesn't, but my
bet is that's what ends up happening unless they find a late fifth-year guy that can help them for 1 year here.
So as we look at the 2014 class, we've already talked about Swift at length. Edmund Sumner, we talked on the last podcast a great deal about. It sounds like X is still looking to fill two spots in that class.
Yeah, as of right now, you know, and again, we talked about the Swift thing, so who knows what will end up happening with that, but theoretically, you're thinking they've got a point guard or a combo-type guard with Edmund Sumner. He's kind of a versatile guy. He's 6'4 and can really score it, but he also looks to be, you know, almost like a Samaje-type point guard in the sense that he really can pass the ball and plays probably better with the ball in his hands. But again, he has the size and the skills to move him off the ball if need be, if you want to grab another point guard. So I think their biggest focus is a wing right now, and a big, a true big, like a real post player center, like Sean O'Mara from Illinois is kind of the top target at this point. The interesting thing right now, it seems like they're really trying to nail down that wing spot. And we've been talking to them forever about Justin Bibbs being that guy that they really want. And I'd say that's still the case. Travis Steele's the lead recruiter on him, and they've been working him hard. Bibbs was just on a visit last week on Sunday, and everything went well. I think ultimately that's not going to happen until at least after July, because he's got Virginia Tech or two more schools that are really on him hard right now that he kind of likes. I don't think Dayton's really a factor, that they've been recruiting him forever as well. But he's going to take a few more visits. And I think his dad definitely wants him to do that. So I don't think anything would happen with that before July. But in addition to Bibbs, there's kind of a couple more guys that they've been really starting to push here. And with Mike Pegues, it's Gabe DeVoe, who's on a visit today. And he's a guy that I think a lot of people kind of felt like he was going to commit to Wake Forest. He's a bigger guard, like a 6'4 guard that's real strong. But really skilled as well, can really handle it and score the basketball and shoot it from the outside a little bit. And he's a guy that, again, had an offer from Wake Forest. I think everyone kind of assumed he was going to commit there. That's where he was leaning. And then they took a commitment from Shelton Mitchell out of North Carolina, who's a top 50 guard. And it kind of changed things. Now he doesn't have an offer from Wake really anymore. And he's sort of looking around and wide open again. And Mike Pegues is a guy who's sort of been recruiting him a little bit. And I think is starting to turn up the heat. I think he's a guy who Xavier definitely sees as being good enough and a guy that they would like. They had him on a visit today, and that's going to be a really interesting one to track. Now, another guy that I have not brought up at all on the message board yet.
Yeah, this is a world exclusive, folks.
Yeah, this is completely new. I haven't mentioned it. And it's a Rick Carter recruit. His name is J.P. McCura. A very interesting, like a 6'5 shooting guard, and he's from Minnesota. Who obviously Xavier, an area Xavier has not recruited a whole lot, but you know he's an aggressive, skilled shooting guard that can really knock down the three ball. Obviously, but he's more than just a shooter. He can get to the rim or play off the dribble a little bit if guys close out too hard on him. So again, he's like a 6'4 guy that isn't just like Brad Redford. I mean, he's not just out there to shoot. He will go around you. He will score at the rim a little bit and has some athleticism, and he's very aggressive. And that's another guy. Again, Rick Carter is recruiting him heavy, and I think they're going to get him on a visit soon. So that's another name there for that other wing spot to really look at right now.
Is this a kid that you could compare – now, you haven't seen him play, obviously, but it sounds like when you're describing his game, he reminds me of the kid from Michigan last year.
Stauskas. Yeah, Nick Stauskas.
Yeah.
And really probably another guy that would be a decent comparison. And again, I haven't seen J.P. McCura play at all, but just from looking at that height and size and the way he plays and talking to a couple people who have obviously scouted him, he compares favorably to Kellen Dunham at Butler, I would think.
Who's a fine player.
And by the way, Butler and Kansas State are two of the schools that have offered him as well. So those are kind of two of his bigger offers, unsurprisingly.
So So we've talked about the wings. We've talked about the bigs for 2014. Anybody else that's sort of on the radar for 2014 that we haven't discussed on the podcast? Obviously, a lot has developed over the course of the last month or so.
Yeah, there's definitely some names that I'll probably throw up there on the message board as they continue to get a few more visitors in. We've talked about a lot of those guys, but I'd say right now those three wings are kind of the priorities for the staff. I think they really want to figure out what's going to happen with that wing spot. They really want to nail that down. I think they feel like that's the most important piece to this class. And then I'd also, again, keep an eye on some of those four guys that we've mentioned, like Jalen Johnson and Justin Tillman, who are both from Michigan.
Do you think, Rick, that Xavier would consider taking two wings if they were able to get, say, Mercuria and Bibbs?
I wouldn't rule it out completely, but I think right now they're really trying. I think it'd be more likely that they take a wing and a point guard, a true point guard. And again, they've got some versatility here. I mean, I think Gabe DeVoe is a guy who's 6'4 and strong. So you look at him as more of like a 2-3, but really he's a combo guard from what I hear. I mean, he's a great ball handler and a guy who plays with the ball in his hands, plays point for his high school team. And then Edmund Sumner being the same way. So
right.
I think that's kind of the way that Steele and Mack really want to play with the guards. They want guys who are just really good players, who are versatile and kind of play either spot.
Yeah, and that's been one of the things that we've seen with X over the last few years is that they don't really – you know, people get hung up on 1-2 – I mean, for Xavier, that position is basically just guard.
Well, and I think the reason being is that they want to stick with that ball screen motion offense, and they want to sort of get back to that. They didn't do it quite as much last year because they had to do some things to get Samaje Christa in the ball. They actually went back to a little bit of the baseline runner offense that they used with Jordan Crawford just to get the ball in his hands more often. But I think they do want to get back to playing with that ball screen way because I think they're all comfortable coaching that way. I think they feel like it does pretty well, especially with their defense. And I think that's why you see that. They don't want just a point guard who's just a distributor. They want point guards who can attack and really score. And I think that's why you see them go after a lot of those combo guards.
One more thing before we get to the fun stuff. Jalen Reynolds and Miles Davis, finally back on the team, finally sort of official Xavier basketball players. Jalen played pretty well at the Devereaux League. Brian Snow wrote sort of a – I don't know how to describe it properly, but Brian had some nice things to say about Miles Davis's conditioning. So, does that jibe with what you've seen with those two guys? They look like they did the right things during their enforced year of idleness.
Yeah, and remember that they weren't technically allowed to work out with the team or practice with the team or anything like that. They're allowed to, you know, work out at the facilities and be at Xavier and everything, but they never actually held workouts with the team. But they did a great job on their own from what it looks like. I mean, Jalen is just a physical freak, and he really has been since he got to Xavier, but it just continues to get more and more impressive as far as his body goes. And with Miles Davis, that was the biggest problem coming in for him was really just he's never been in very good shape. He's always kind of been a chubby guard that can really score. And now he's looking like, hey, I can't put it this way. I don't see how getting a lot thinner while at the same time getting stronger and quicker is going to hurt him as a basketball player. So I think it's definitely those guys have done all the work that they need to do as far as their bodies goes in the offseason. The other thing that I've seen from Jalen Reynolds that I've been really impressed with is, you know, we've always talked about him as being kind of a rambunctious guy. He's very aggressive inside. He's you know, we've talked about the concern that he may foul too much on defense. But one of the things on offense that I've really seen developed all of a sudden, and I don't know if it's just where it's coming from, is just he seems to have a plan now when he catches the ball in the post. Yeah, sometimes he's a little over-aggressive, tries to dunk over people. I saw someone mention that he needs to learn to stop doing that. I disagree. I think that's great. I think you want that out of your big men. But he catches the ball, and he made a couple just fantastic passes out of the post last weekend at the Summer League that really impressed me. And then a couple of other times, he sort of had calculated moves in the post where he's had his back to the basket and he's had a move and then the guys cut him off and he's had a counter to that move and he's really worked on his footwork it looks like and just everything about his back to the basket game looks better and just more polished. I think he's still got a ways to go when it comes to that, but it's definitely improving, and if he continues to go at this rate, I mean, Jalen Reynolds is a guy with absolutely has the physical tools to play in the NBA. He's just got to continue to develop like he is. But I think Xavier fans are going to be very impressed with him. It's going to be tough to keep him off the court this year.
Two quick comments, and then we'll move on to the potpourri round. First of all, I think it, as difficult as it was for those two guys to sit there and watch their teammates play last year, I think that having a year where they could concentrate on academics and concentrate on off-the-court preparation will pay dividends for both of those guys this season.
Which, by the way, I should report on, because this is probably one of the more important things. They both took care of business in the classroom too. And it's worth noting for Miles, it was never a situation that he wasn't the type of kid who took care of business in the classroom. He got screwed from the prep school deal.
Right.
So there's some, you know, it's not like they're bad students or anything like that, but they really took care of business this year in their year off in the books, and they're going to be fine going forward academically.
Second thing, the thing that I like the most from the video you posted of Jalen Reynolds, great foul shooting form.
Yeah, his free throws have looked good. You are right about that.
And that always is – and that was something that drove people nuts last year. X probably lost 3 or 4 games because of their inability to hit foul shots. And, you know, if we see a little bit of improvement from Samaje Christen and the bigs shoot a little bit better than Travis Taylor did last season, X should see a concomitant improvement as far as that goes. Rick – the NBA draft has just started. Let's start with the NBA. I'm changing up the agenda a little bit. This NBA playoff season, which just ended this last week, was one of the most exciting and memorable in recent memory. But it taught us absolutely nothing that we didn't already know. Because we already knew that LeBron James was the best player in basketball. And we already knew that the Miami Heat, if Dwayne Wade contributed, were going to be very difficult to stop. And we knew San Antonio was well coached and had the craftiness and sort of the old man strength that we talked about. And that's exactly the way it played out. At the end of the day, LeBron James scores 37 points in Game 7, one of the greatest Game 7 performances of all time. And what did we learn? Very little, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right, though. I will say, I mean, I hate saying this, I hate hyperbole. I can't remember a better NBA final series in my lifetime that I enjoyed watching more. I mean, there may have been a closer one or whatever, but as far as being invested in, and really getting into the two teams and watching them and just having great games, I can't remember enjoying an NBA final series more than that one.
Rick, I realized as I was sitting there watching Game 7 that it was – so. It was probably the 20th night that I had been sitting on my couch rooting for the Miami Heat to lose in the last 6 weeks. I was like, that's pretty amazing. I've watched probably more Miami Heat basketball over the last 2 months than I watched Xavier basketball this year. So, I mean, it was absolutely riveting. The Indiana series was great. The San Antonio series obviously was outstanding. Tonight, the NBA draft has just started. I wanted to ask you, you know, you get to see all the big time prospects. Now with the one and done rule, we get to see all of them except for the European guys, at least for 1 year. Who can you give me one guy that you think out of this, you know, we acknowledge that it's a weak class, but one guy that you think is going to be a really good pro and one guy that's maybe end of the first round, second round guy that you think will be better than expected?
I'd say the most sure thing in the draft to me is Otto Porter, though a close second is Victor Oladipo. I love Victor Oladipo. And that being said, if I had the number one pick in the draft, I would take Nerlens Noel. I think he's got the best upside, and I already think that he's a game-changing defender in the post in the NBA, and there just aren't a lot of those. I mean, he's a double-double guy just off of physical tools and effort. Similar to like how Joakim Noah plays. I mean, he gets double-doubles just off of effort. And I think Nerlens Noel would be at least that guy. And if he ever develops the offensive game in the post, he could end up being a phenomenal talent in the NBA. So I think he would be my number one pick if I had to go. But my sure things would be Porter and Oladipo. As far as the guy who's going to shock some people, that's a tough call. I would say Deshaun Thomas is the guy that I'm really surprised continues to slip. as much as he has. And the reason I say that is because all of the concerns that I'm hearing coming out about him were the same exact concerns I heard about him going into college, and he continued to prove that he can play at elite level despite that. Now, yes, the defenders in the NBA are going to be better and everything like that. I get that part of it. I think the biggest concern in the NBA is that he doesn't guard, and in the college you can hide that and get away with it. In the NBA, you can't. If you can't guard, your man will score 20 every single night.
Right.
So I think that's one of the biggest concerns, but I still just look at him, and I think with that body, and I know he's not a good athlete by NBA standards, but I really think he can score, and I think he'll surprise people. The people are talking about him not getting drafted tonight or being an end-of-the-second-round guy, and I just don't see that.
Well, my sort of pick to be a really outstanding player is Macklemore.
Yeah, I think he's great too, by the way.
I think he's an absolute stud. I think he's got the size that you need from a scoring guard in the NBA, and I don't think there's a whole lot needs to be said about him. I'm kind of pissed off because the guy that I had selected for my sort of sleeper for this draft, I thought had flown completely under the radar, and then there was an article on Grantland about him today. Arsalan Kazemi, the center who played at Oregon last year, who had transferred from Rice the previous year, who is just a gigantic wide body, a great rebounder, great instinctive rebounder, and like you said, is a guy that just because of the size of his body, just because of his positioning, can score lots of points just based on that. I see a little bit of a Marc Gasol type thing, maybe.
I honest to God was waiting for you to finish so I could say how much of this has to do with the fact that you think he can be the next Marc Gasol.
It has everything to do with it. Because, Rick, there just aren't that many great centers in the NBA anymore. I mean, it really is a little bit of a dying breed.
You're absolutely right.
And what happens when you have that scarcity is that you don't have to be elite to be a game changer at that point, because you have a commodity that other teams don't have. I mean, hell, Marcus Camby is still productive couple of years. So,
and that's why I laugh at all the flack that Nerlens Noel is getting right now about, you know, he's not going to be – he doesn't have post skills. He's not a true center as far as on offense. And I'm like, who the hell is right now?
Right.
I mean, he's a game-changing defender and a great rebounder. There aren't a lot of those in the NBA, period. There's a lot of guys who want to face up right now.
Wait. Did the Cavs really just take Anthony Bennett?
Nuh-uh.
What's going on here?
Breaking news on the Dana Victory podcast. Anthony Bennett with the number one pick. You are absolutely right.
Okay. Well, we're going to leave that in. We're not going to edit that out just so you can get our complete shock and surprise by that pick. You know, Bennett's a good player. He was pretty good for UNLV this year, but I mean, I thought there were issues with his weight. I thought there were questions about his conditioning, and I had read something, I think from Jeff Goodman today, that he might fall as far as 8 in this draft.
Yeah. By the way, I really like Anthony Bennett. Number one though, that's interesting for sure.
Okay. Well, so moving on from the NBA, the other championship that wrapped up last week was the NHL. A fantastic finish. I don't know if you watched it, but Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Finals was one of the more exciting finishes to a championship decider I can remember, with the Chicago Blackhawks scoring twice in 20 seconds to beat Boston. And the reason that I wanted to bring it up is, first of all, you know, I feel like hockey is really exciting and the Stanley Cup playoffs are always awesome, but every time I watch the game, you know, I feel like, wow, this is great. I should really watch more hockey, and then I don't. So I feel like, Rick, you and I are on the same wavelength as far as this goes. What do you attribute that to? Is it the fact that we don't have a team, or is it just the fact that the game just doesn't translate to what we're looking for, I guess?
We are in the same exact boat, because it was funny. I didn't even watch, you know, the fantastic Game 6 and all that. I watched when the Blackhawks closed out the semifinal series, whatever it's called in hockey, and it went into double or triple overtime or whatever that was. And I'm a sucker for anything overtime, and I'm a sucker for any postseason in any sport, really. But I'm watching it and going, you know, I'll see a minute of this or so because it's an overtime. I end up watching an hour and a half of these overtimes, and they've got basically a halftime show in between each overtime period and all this other stuff. I mean, it was ridiculous. It took forever, but it was riveting. I mean, I was watching the entire time, and I didn't watch a single game of the Stanley Cup after that. I don't know the reason, because I'm with you. I was sitting there thinking the whole time, I'm surprised I don't watch a little more hockey.
Well, I actually was sitting at lunch the day after Game 6, and I was sitting there at lunch with a couple of guys that you and I both know that we go to Reds games with every once in a while, guys that are huge sports fans, and all of them had the same response. And the only thing we could work out is that the only quote-unquote home team that we have are the Columbus Blue Jackets, and they've been garbage since they came into the NHL. Yeah. But, you know, I probably will – you know, I'm probably going to – going to think very hard, because last year during the Stanley Cup playoffs, I was in Nashville visiting a friend. Nashville, you know, not a what you would expect to be a hockey town, and the Predators were in the Western Conference final, and it was a huge thing. Like, it was a huge party downtown, and everybody was going nuts for the playoff game. So I don't know. It seems like the NHL is definitely on the rise, and hopefully I can find a way into that sport. But the reason that I wanted to bring that up, Rick, is to talk about the announcer, Mike Emmerich, who does, I think, the New Jersey Devils regularly, but he actually is a Miami U guy, got one of his degrees at Miami U from Southern Indiana. He is the play-by-play guy for the NHL playoffs on NBC Sports, and I have to tell you, I have never heard a better play-by-play guy in any sport, bar none. There's something about the way he calls a game. Because hockey is so scattershot, and because chances arrive out of nowhere, he has this unbelievable way of keeping the cadence of his voice, of building up tension and letting it go down, and building up tension and letting it go down. And I just think he's fantastic. And I don't know if you saw any games that he called. But the question I was going to ask you is, as somebody that's in radio that has done play-by-play, what do you think are the best attributes for a play-by-play guy?
To me, it's all about pace. I'm big on pace. I find that any play-by-play guy that's either too slow and drawn out with everything or leaves too much dead air, I tend to not like usually. And then on the flip side of that, you sometimes get play-by-play guys who talk way too much, and they're constantly talking, and they're talking fast, and they're going into stories and details that you really don't need, and you want to get on with whatever's going on in the game, and I get that. The other thing I cannot stand is, and Tom Brennaman is as guilty of this as anyone, and I really liked Tom when he first came to the Reds. He's starting to wear on me the longer he stays, is how often you have to interject your personal theories and make it about you more so. And I don't mind opinion, because that's what you're supposed to do, but I don't need why this relates to your life or why this relates to something that you said a while ago or anything like that. I get a little annoyed when it gets too much about that guy. And if you do it once in a while, it's one thing, but like Tom Brennan will find a way to bring himself into every single topic that comes up during a Reds game.
Well, I mean, for me, one of the best guys that's doing basketball as a play-by-play guy on TV is Mike Breen, who no one knows his name. He's the guy – he's Van Gundy's partner on the NBA, and he's fantastic because he's completely low-key. He just describes the action. He gives it the space it needs. He doesn't inject his ego into the game. He gives Van Gundy space to analyze the game. He gives whoever the third – sometimes they have Reggie Miller, sometimes they have another third man in the booth, gives that person an opportunity, but it's just a professional, low-key performance. And the guy that I grew up with that sort of exemplifies that is Pat Summerall calling the NFL. But the thing that I love – I guess –
when he's not blackout drunk.
Well, I mean, he fell
– The 25. I'm in the bag, John. Take over.
That was true earlier in his career, no questions asked. But the thing that I really enjoy about Emmerich is just that he understands the immediacy of the game, and I think that it takes a different cadence and this is what we talked about with Gus Johnson, is I don't know that guys that are built for hockey – I don't know that Mike Emmerich could call a basketball game or a baseball game, certainly not a baseball game. But by the same token, I don't know if I'd want Vin Scully calling Game 7 of the NBA Finals. There definitely is a different pace to each different thing you hear. And when you get the opportunity to hear somebody that's really good at calling a game – and I think of Ian Dark in the World Cup or Martin Tyler in the World Cup. And I think of a guy like Mike Breen in the NBA or Emmerich in the NHL. It really is a joy. And I have to say we rag on media guys a lot on this show. And people rag on media guys a lot on the internet just because that's 90% of why the internet exists, as far as I can tell. But I always am just stunned and overjoyed when a guy that's calling a game actually increases my enjoyment. And Mike Emmerich is one guy who I think really does that.
Absolutely. I'm not going to go with you on Emmerich just because I don't know enough. But I agree with exactly what you said. And I think that you put it perfectly, is that they understand the immediacy of the game. And also understand, I mean, there's a completely different sound I want for a regular season, middle of the year game between two teams I don't give a crap about and the NBA Finals or, you know, the NCAA tournament or something like that. There's definitely – I need a little more entertainment, a little more side notes there in that middle of the season game. Whereas when it's the biggest game of the year, just stick to the game.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. I think that finishes off episode number 31 of the Dan and Victory podcast. We've run pretty long, but given all the stuff that's transpired over the last month, it was probably worth it. We'll probably start picking up a little bit more, picking up the frequency a little bit more as we get toward the end of the summer and the beginning of the school year. Rick, any last thoughts before we adjourn?
No, just that all these teams are lining up right now in the draft. They're all just trying to they're not going to hit it over the water and take their chance with Noel, it looks like. They're all taking – you know, Bennett looks like a shock. But at the same time, he's probably one of the more sure things in the draft as well. In the same sense that you would put a guy like Oladipo or Otto Porter in, he's probably similar in that mold that he's going to be a solid NBA player without question. It seems like that's the approach all these teams are taking as it's gone Bennett, Oladipo, and now Porter. So
it just seems to me that getting the first pick in this particular NBA draft was like getting a $1,000 gift card to Golden Corral when you would rather go eat at Ruth's Chris or at Morton's or something like that. I mean, the draft class this year just is it really is weak, and there are no sure things. I mean, Oladipo, Bennett, Porter, that's
– I think this draft is a lot deeper than people realize. There's just not the elite talents at the top that you look at and say – that's going to be a Kyrie Irving. You know, that's going to be a
right
superstar here in the first couple of years. There's a lot of guys, though. I think there's great value at the end of the first and beginning of the second round with guys that are going to be able to start for your team over the next 5 years and be solid players.
And we'll see how that transpires later tonight. By the time you hear that, you will know all about what happened.
That's right. We're telling you about a draft that's going to be completely over by the time you hear this.
Right.
You're done listening anyway.
That's a great podcast, Rick. So we didn't get canceled after number 30, but we might get canceled after number 31.
And if not, we'll see you for the Kenny Freeze edition coming up here in a couple of weeks. All
Absolutely.
Right. This is the Dana Victory podcast. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.